When I accepted Sean's request to light the chalice, and in the context of October's topic, healing, to talk about how being a parish visitor impacts my life, I thought about warm fuzzies, a cute term, but profound. There's a whole wonderful story about warm fuzzies and cold pricklies that I really like, and you may want to check it out. But I'm just talking about warm fuzzies. Warm fuzzies are those warm human connections we give to and get from each other. The first time I recognized them, I was a very little girl. Around the winter holidays, my mother would ask me to bring all my old crayons to the kitchen to share them to make candles for other people. We had containers shaped like cones or Christmas trees from orange juice. Then, first we'd put a string in, poke a hole in the bottom, and hold it straight by winding a pencil with the string on it around the top. We melted my crayons one color at a time in the top of a double boiler. Then we poured them one color at a time into the cone-shaped containers with paraffin wax layers in between. When they cooled, we topped them off by drizzling paraffin or any color crayon over the top. I always thought they were beautiful. Then we baked cookies, dozens of cookies. We took the candles and the cookies to people my mother referred to as shut-ins, folks who didn't get out of their houses much. When we came with our cookies and candles, they let us know that they were deeply happy by their radiant smiles, sometimes hugs, sometimes even tears. They gave us back appreciative love. And these precious human connections are always available to us, for us to give and receive. They can be likes on Facebook, smiles for people who don't seem to have smiles of their own, reaching out to folks, including kids, maybe especially kids, who seem different or troubled. Hugs, patience, respect, kindness messages. As a parish visitor, when I visit someone, I feel the same feelings I felt as a little girl. We both are blessed and healed by experiencing deep, warm human connection. They feel loved, and so do I. The term warm fuzzies is simplistic, but the experience is sacred. As I light this chalice, I pray its flame will ignite warm fuzzies by the hundreds to fly off throughout this church. To each of us here today, let us embrace them and share them with all the people we encounter in our lives.
I'm going to share a story today about caring. You all know what caring is, right? Can someone tell me an example of something caring? Yeah? When you care about people. Yes, that's very true. What about sometime someone cared about you? You can shout it out, I'll repeat it. Come on. The meal train at church, when someone needs food and people sign up. It's very caring. All right. So, now that you know what caring is. This is a story about a knight named Percival and a time that he had to make a very difficult choice. So I want you all to listen very carefully to see if you can find the moment in which he makes that choice. A long time ago, there was a knight in shining armor named Percival. And Percival was out on a quest to find a very important cup. Percival was riding his horse for days. And because he was a knight, he had a lot of armor on, right? And that armor's hot. It's kind of like wearing a sweater in summer. And in this land, nothing was able to grow. I mean, there were no trees, there was no plants, he couldn't even find any shade, and he never saw any animals. Something is very wrong with this place, Percival thought. That was just as his stomach started grumbling. He hadn't eaten for days, and he was getting tired. He hadn't slept. He thought he was going to be lost forever. And just at that moment, he bumped into a man dressed in very fancy clothes. And he asked the man, "Where can I find somewhere to sleep?" And the man said, "Well, actually, I'm a prince of this land, and you can come stay in the castle that my father has." So the prince brought him to the castle, and when he arrived, the prince said, "Well, you should come meet my father." And then Percival said, "Of course, he's letting me stay in his castle. I should go meet him." So as Percival entered the king's throne room, he started to smell a really bad smell. He looked at the prince, and the prince didn't seem to notice. But when Percival approached the king, the smell seemed to get even worse. And he finally saw where it was coming from. You see, the king had this wound on his leg. It was green and it was oozing. It was just, okay, it was bad. And Percival, well, he felt a lot of sadness. Like, why was the king hurt? And he looked around at the prince and all the people gathered to see the king, and no one was doing anything about it. They didn't even seem to notice. The king seemed to be in so much pain, and no one seemed to care. He thought, maybe I should say something. Maybe I should ask him if he's all right. But no one else was doing that. He didn't want to be rude, of course. Maybe this is just the way it was. So he didn't say anything. He approached the king, shook his hand, and went to bed that night. See, what Percival didn't know was that a witch had cast a spell on the king to stop him from getting better. And that's why nothing could grow in the land. And there was only one thing that could break the spell. And that's if someone asked the king, a stranger, asked the king a caring question. That would break the spell. That would allow the king to be better. But Percival, he wasn't up to it. And when he awoke in the morning, imagine his surprise when he awoke and the castle was gone. Nothing. He looked around, you know, how could a castle disappear, he thought to himself, and he couldn't see it anywhere. And just then he heard a whoosh, and he turned around, and there was a witch. The witch who had cast that spell, a witch whose name was Cindy, actually. And Cindy said to him, "Percival, you call yourself a knight. You call yourself a knight. You saw someone in pain, and you didn't ask him how he was. You didn't do anything." There was a part of Percival's heart that broke in that moment. And so he said to the witch, "You're so right. I wanted to, but I didn't." So he got on his horse and he searched for years and years trying to find that castle again. And what do you think he did when he found it? Yes, he asked the king. He strode into the king's room. He smelled that terrible smell and he walked right up to the king and he said, "Are you okay?" And in that moment, everything changed. The king's wounds started to be knit up. He looked outside and there were trees starting to bloom and grow, and animals and rabbits were jumping everywhere. Life had returned to the kingdom. This story of Percival reminds me that when we ask caring questions of other people, maybe our friends, maybe our parents, or even strangers, the whole world can be changed. I wonder what situations each of us have noticed that could be help with a caring question. I hope each of us has the courage to ask those questions and to see what happens. Someone dressed up as a witch. It's great. I want to get something settled right from the beginning. You should read nothing into the fact that on the day we install Gretchen as our senior minister, I am preaching a sermon entitled Accepting Apocalypse. I am in no way expecting the rapture to occur at 4 p.m. today, nor am I even foreshadowing the appearance of one of the horsemen of the apocalypse. When I was a kid, I watched a lot of the TV show Arthur. You might be aware of it. Arthur is a cartoon aardvark. And there's this one episode that has been etched into my mind ever since I watched it. It's the episode in which Arthur sees on TV moon boots, these springy contraptions that once you put them on your feet, you can bound like you're in zero G. He goes to his parents asking for a handout so that he can afford them. And they do what most parents do in this case and say, well, you could earn some extra money by cleaning out the garage. So Arthur sets to his work, taking the various detritus and forgotten objects off the shelves and placing them onto the driveway for sorting. And this is where the plot begins to thicken. It's when Arthur's neighbor, Mrs. Tibble, wanders over. Now, Mrs. Tibble is a lovely old woman, usually welcoming Arthur and his sister, D.W., in for cookies and milk. But this time, she wasn't to play that device in the story. For Mrs. Tibble mistook the cleanup for a yard sale. And she spotted a beautiful necklace that belonged to Arthur's grandmother and asks if she could purchase it. And Arthur pauses to consider this. A little imagination bubble pops into view. You can see his vision of bounding in his moon boots. Of course, it would be morally wrong for him to do this. Morally wrong for him to sell the necklace, and I thought my hero would not fall for this deception. But instead of correcting her, Arthur was intoxicated with the vision of the boots, and he agreed to the sale. And it was in that moment, when the necklace and those 30 pieces of silver were being exchanged, it was in that moment that I lunged from the couch, lunging towards that button, that off button on the TV, and I turned it off. I couldn't watch my hero do something wrong. I mean, I was the kid who didn't lock up his locker at the swim pool one day, returning to find my wallet stolen, and I was utterly crushed. Not crushed about losing anything in the wallet, mind you. I was crushed because someone took something that they knew wasn't theirs. That there was malice in the world. That world I lived in all of my childhood ended in that moment. The underlying element that I wouldn't have been able to notice at the time, but I still see creeping up in me from time to time, is when the world causes me pain, like watching Arthur's unethical act, like watching the evening news and being reminded once again of the terrors of the world, I notice that impulse to reach for the knob and to turn it off, to turn away. I imagine I'm not alone in that, in reaching from the off button when the pain of the world gets too much. It's actually a biological response. There's these neurons in our brain called mirror neurons, and they fire. When we see pain going on in the world, we feel that pain. It's the biological root of empathy. So no wonder when we feel pain in the world, we have that desire to turn it off, to dull it. And in our day and age, never before have we had so much access to the sources to witness the pain of the world. We need not only look in many of our pockets to find a porthole into the horrors of existence, sensationalized, but still true. The news of the world brings us week after week the killing of another black and brown man by police, or maybe another report from the front lines of climate change, or maybe just another story about the body blows of life, of diagnosis or misconduct, of heartache. Our hearts weep. Our hearts crack. Even if these stories are far away and we can't pronounce the names, it becomes too easy to reach and to turn it off. Like normal, sane beings. And when we avoid that pain and the grief, in many ways, we can get busy, we can numb it with drugs and alcohol, or we can become consumed by the cycle, letting it desensitize us, or we simply just look away. In 2013, a survey done by a reputable polling company found that 41% of Americans agreed with this statement. The world that we are currently living in is in the end times, as described by the Bible. 41% of Americans. 54% of Protestants agreed with this. 77% of evangelicals agreed with it. The only major Christian denomination that disagreed with this was Catholics. I found that fascinating. While Unitarian Universalists were not specifically surveyed in this, with a slight tweak of the question, I wouldn't be surprised if we polled as high as Protestants if we were asked if we believe that human existence is maybe in its end times due to climate change. Asked another way, the question is, are you optimistic about our chances of survival given what you know? The end times, Armageddon, apocalypse. In popular culture, we see lakes of fire, utter destruction of everything we know. But if we read the apocalyptic writings in the Bible, in Revelation, in the book of Daniel, it consists rather of the unveiling of a vision of the future, a forthcoming destruction. But as Unitarian Universalists who rely less on heavenly messengers for their harbingers of apocalypse and more on the New York Times and Rachel Maddow, it might be not a good place to go. But I wonder if it's time for us to recast this term. Apocalypse not as the forthcoming or future destruction of the world, but as any time a world ends, past, present, or future. That our world has survived many apocalypses, hundreds of times, and maybe you have even. When a loved one dies and our whole world seems to die with them. The primary feature of these apocalypses, what makes an apocalyptic moment different than just a trying one, is that in that apocalyptic one, we lose the ability to see a future that we hope to live in. We can't see it, it's shrouded. I think we all know of that apocalypse. Which is why I do think, maybe, that we do live in times of apocalypse, when our vision of the future that we want to live in is shrouded. We ask ourselves, like, how do we maintain hope? Should we? Does accepting this diagnosis mean we give up? And while many of you might not go as far with me as this idea of apocalypse, for me, it uncovers a fear amid all the talk of the end times, a fear that is hard to speak about, the fear that if we acknowledge the true reality, the true gravity of our current times, that we'll be plunged into despair and consumed by that acknowledgement. Tossing us into this cycle of fear, that the more the world feels overwhelming, the less we're inclined to see it. And the less we see it, the less we're able to help our world. And the less we feel we can help it, the more overwhelming it feels. A feedback cycle that we cannot speak about, for that would make it all too real. On a more personal level, I know of this feedback cycle all too well. When I was in college, we were constantly told we needed to get tested for HIV. Now, as a queer guy, I've lived my whole life with a non-rational paranoia about getting HIV. Being gay and having HIV are connected in our society. This fear is pretty irrational, not only because I've been through our Face Our Whole Lives program and taught it twice, and also because I practice responsibility, but it's also irrational because I know that when detected and treated, HIV is just another chronic condition that is very manageable and has no bearing on life expectancy. And yet I found this fear in me. Every time I saw a poster that reminded me that I should get tested, a panic would unleash inside me. I was in that feedback cycle of fear, you know. If I were to get tested, I would know for certain my status. And if I knew for certain my status, I didn't know if it could handle the result if it came back positive. I couldn't see a future. It wasn't logical or in my best interest, but I didn't get tested. In fact, this is the reason that many people don't get tested. It's why many of us hesitate or consider not looking at our report cards when they're handed out by the teacher, or the results of a medical exam. We become paralyzed in this apocalyptic moment where we can't imagine the future, so we just don't look. It's hard to speak about this grief and this sorrow that we feel for the world. It's hard to share that inner space with other people, because what if we break down? What if we cry? What if by saying it, it makes it all too real? We don't want to overwhelm each other with what is going on inside ourselves, so we hold onto our pain and our grief alone. We pave over our pain, not embracing it, so we shut down. Our hearts harden. And so in these end times, if you were, I'm going to invite you into a countercultural practice, a practice of accepting apocalypse, of allowing ourselves to embrace the pain and the grief we feel for the world and its suffering, of tuning into it, allowing ourselves to dwell in the possibility that we can't see the future right now. This is so countercultural because in our society, we are often told that we need to be hopeful or optimistic, or just not to pay attention. Those are the choices. Don't get me wrong here, though. I'm not advocating for us to actively seek out stories that break our hearts. I'm inviting us to no longer try to guard our hearts from breaking and free ourselves from an enforced optimism, no longer accepting it as the price of admission in society. Joanna Macy, a Buddhist teacher and ecologist, writes this: "I am not insisting that we are brimming with hope. It is okay not to be optimistic. Buddhist teachings say that the feeling that you have to maintain hope can wear you out. Whether you're hopeful or hopeless or pessimistic or optimistic, who cares? The main thing is that you're showing up, that you're here, that you're finding an ever more capacity to love this world, because it will not be healed without that. That is what is going to unleash our intelligence, our ingenuity, and our solidarity for healing the world. We don't have to be optimistic. We don't have to be hopeful. We don't even have to see the future. We simply need to be present. But doing this is hard work. Maybe one of the hardest things we can do. It's the type of thing that makes Anne Lamott want to sit beside you at dinner, which is pretty cool. But I think we can do this. I know we can. Because we're the type of people who don't come to a church that peddles false hope. We don't come here to church to hear a message that says, when God closes one door, he opens another. This is one of the gifts of our humanist tradition. This isn't some sort of backdoor nihilism either. It's actually a process of developing a deeper compassion. In being present to all that goes on in the world, we return once more to that original meaning of that word, compassion, to suffer with. Suffering with our world, we are drawn into a cauldron of compassion. It's there, it awaits us, for it reconnects us with our power. For we learn one indelible truth from not running away from our pain and our grief: that our heart cannot break from that which it is disconnected from. That's the deepest truth of our interdependence. The power that we find when we embrace the pain and the grief that is so natural for us to feel. The truth is that it reveals to us our interconnection. The deepest of interconnection between us and the world and the earth. all of us, together. And when we break from that cycle of fear and avoidance, of fearing being overwhelmed by the nature of life's grief, we learn that, yeah, it is too much. That's the truth. We don't need to shelter ourselves. We pry ourselves from an apocalyptic paralysis because it is no longer daunting to believe that despite all of it, we can still do so much good. Because our healing work does not depend on perfecting the whole world, nor getting it all right or fixing it all. We are released and freed from having to deny the truth of how we feel, and that releases the love that we have within. When we accept apocalypse, the sky doesn't fall. It opens up. And through it comes a way forward, one that no one of us could have imagined, forged of the love that we are lavishing upon the world when we feel our love is just the other side of pain. One day in college, I chose not to turn away from my fear. I accepted that despite not being able to see a future, that I might have HIV. I let that fear and despair flood in. I welcomed it in. And I prayed that prayer that each of us, regardless of our theologies, have prayed at one point in our lives. I am afraid, I am scared, and I don't know what's going to happen. And once that tempest had ran its course, once I let it in, with the company of friends by my side, I went to get tested. And I heard the results. And this is that moment where you're all wondering, isn't it? You're wondering my status, positive or negative. You want to hear the end of the story, right? You want to feel resolved? But in a sermon entitled Accepting Apocalypse, did you truly think you were going to get off that easy? The reason I'm not going to tell you is because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what that test came back. Once I allowed that fear to stop the paralysis, I was able to take that test, hear the result, and live a full and vibrant life, no matter the results. This may cause you some discomfort. You want to know I am okay, stemming from curiosity or compassion. But living through the tension of unknowing together is where healing finds us. Where love finds us. Finding the interconnecting link between our pain and discomfort and compassion and love. I invite you to seek me out during the week if you want to talk about that discomfort of living without resolution, without future. The poet Rilke wrote, "Just give me a little more time. I want to love the things as no one has thought to love them." That is what we are called to do. No matter if we are living in the end times, no matter if the world is ending, no matter if we are hopeful, pessimistic, no matter any of that, we are simply called to love the world as no one has thought to before. And we do that by finding that place of compassion, where we allow that pain to be joined with our own. That unleashes courageous love in us. Amen.